This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. The great state of Wisconsin is home to the only master cheesemaking program outside of Switzerland. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all the previous episodes of Feast Your Ears can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. This year is Heritage Radio Network's 10th anniversary. Please join us for a spectacular gala coming up on November 11th at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. www.heritageradionetwork.org/gala. It's going to be awesome. I'm making food. Other hosts are making food. There's going to be chefs. There's going to be cheese. There's going to be booze. There's going to be wine. There's going to be music. So you should come on out and have a party with us. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I'd love it if you'd leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. Today's theme. Did you hear about the chef that makes his own salt? I know what you're thinking. Another chef who does things by hand that the Industrial Revolution was supposed to save us from. What's next, a chef who carries his own water from the well? I know it may seem like a cliche, but I have to say I love the idea of making your own salt. Or more accurately, harvesting it. It's not that hard to do. In his River Cottage family cookbook, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall includes a recipe for it. You harvest some good clean water from the ocean, and you just boil off the water. I mean, how did you think salt was made? There are so many things that when you do them yourself, they just taste better. I canned some tomatoes over the weekend. I also made some applesauce. It just tastes better. Maybe it's the quality of the ingredients. Maybe it's the blood, sweat, and tears. Maybe it's the fewer miles on the truck or the music I was listening to. All of this combines to make the food you handle, and especially the food that's almost always made industrially, just that much better. Last week, I crossed the Hudson River to Hoboken, New Jersey, to sit down with Chef Seiden Schaus of Halifax Restaurant. We talked about salt, which he makes himself, about seaweed, about mushrooms, and a whole lot more. So tune in. Give it a listen. Would you just introduce yourself and tell me like what you do now? Like when you sit down next to somebody on an airplane and they say, hey, who are you? What do you say?
I'm a chef, so I'm a and at Halifax Restaurant. And as well as a chef partner in Timber Cove Resort, which is in Jenner, California.
It's beautiful out there.
It is. I just got back end of last week.
Nice. Yeah. It's a good time. Good time of year out there.
It's beautiful. Yeah, yeah. I like it because it's not. I mean, it's never hot there on the coast.
Right.
Ever. But this time of year, it's windy, but it's usually pretty sunny.
Yeah.
And then the winter gets kind of windy, but then pretty rainy as well. So this is a perfect time.
So when you say got back, we're sitting right now in Halifax, which is your restaurant at the W Hotel in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And how long has it been open?
3.5 years. Yeah. Halifax has been open 3.5 years. Before that, it was a different restaurant, but yep. Now Halifax 3.5.
Okay. And it's named Halifax because you're from Nova Scotia.
Correct. Yes, I was born in Nova Scotia on the South Shore. Halifax is about 2 hours north of where I was born.
Yep.
And the restaurant's not necessarily named Halifax for me. That's one of it, yeah. Part of it, but it's named mostly because it's a coastal, Halifax is a coastal city,
yep.
And that's kind of what we wanted Halifax to be, is kind of more coastal cuisine, northeastern farm and coastal is what we're considering. Yeah.
So I was looking up, you grew up in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Yes.
And I was looking at the map and I realized I've actually been there. In the summer of 1993, I did a bicycle trip, like an outdoors trip, in Nova Scotia. And we did a whole bunch of different stuff, but part of it was bicycling. And we bicycled kind of across the middle of Nova Scotia where there's a big national park.
Okay.
And we ended up in Liverpool.
Wow.
Or in that
area. Very interesting. I actually might have done the same bicycle, not at the same time, but as a fundraiser for a friend of mine's father. We did a bike across from Liverpool to Digby, Nova Scotia.
Sure.
So in the valley.
Yeah.
And that was so it would have been probably most of the same roads.
Right, the same roads. That's funny. So you lived there until how long?
Until 99.
Okay.
So I lived there until I was 15.
Okay.
And then moved to Virginia.
Right. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, like, how did Nova Scotia shape what you do now? And then Virginia. Like, that's a pretty, you know, were you near the ocean in Virginia?
No, central in the mountains.
So that's pretty stark difference.
Very, very big difference. A little shocker from a little Nova Scotia kid to moving to Virginia. So, I mean, Nova Scotia more shaped me in my career the past 4 years since I'd more than in the past. And I think that was because before I was working at other restaurants, French restaurants, Italian restaurants, mostly, actually solely French and Italian. And it was all about their cuisine. It wasn't really about my cuisine or kind of my upbringing. So that was kind of where my kind of career was taking me, was in those kind of directions until I had the opportunity for Halifax. And that's kind of when I got to do my own kind of cuisine and based off of my upbringing.
Are there dishes on the menu that are like remind you of your childhood?
Quite a bit, yes. More so, not fully dishes, but ingredients.
Got it.
So one item, the maple smoked salmon, was a childhood favorite in Nova Scotia, picking it up at the grocery store. It's made in the fish department. You have fresh fish and you have the smoked fish, and the maple salmon was one of my favorites. Kind of like candy. It's almost like salmon candy. So that was one of my favorites, and that was one that I never thought to kind of even try until we were discussing opening Halifax, and thought, okay, that's something that I loved. Let me see if I can figure out how to do it, and now it's one of my favorite dishes. So
that's awesome.
That's 100% childhood right there.
And you do a lot of cured meat as well yourself in the restaurant.
Yes, cured meats, cured meats, and then smoked fish.
Yep, awesome. You have an interesting relationship with salt, right?
Yes.
Tell me about your salt.
Salts, yeah. So another item kind of developed with the opening of Halifax is that I kind of wanted something to be different. I wanted to be different. And the idea I had was, if I can do it myself, why not? So my wife and I...
Hence the cured meats.
Correct, right. Exactly. And my wife and I enjoy driving out to Montauk to basically, as more so for just kind of a foraging trip is where it started. Seaweed. We'd pick mussels for ourselves, not for the restaurant. And every now and then you find an oyster, but periwinkles. And then it got to a point where it was a beautiful area where we'd go to near the lighthouse, and very secluded. We'd usually build a fire on the rocks and cook right there on the rocks, and thought, why not? I'd try making sea salt. So brought a couple buckets went to Home Depot and got a couple buckets of couple buckets and got some water and brought it back and kind of figured it out. So we've been making sea salt ever since.
That's awesome.
4 years now.
And how do you use it? Do you use it in most of the dishes? Is it for customers to use for finishing?
It's a finishing salt in the kitchen.
So
as far as for customers to use, I would love to, but it's natural sea salt. It has a little higher moisture content.
Sure.
It kind of clumps up in a shaker. So certain customers, especially some of our regulars, will ask for it, and we'll give them a little dish on the side. But we finish all the steaks with the sea salt and a couple other dishes.
Nice. And how do you find that, like, for you from a culinary standpoint, what does that do for the steak? Like, let's say you just finished it with, I don't know, whatever salt was in the kitchen, you know, kosher salt, let's say, versus the sea salt.
So really, I mean, I would love to say that it makes it so much more amazing. But really, I don't think on a steak you're going to notice the difference, other than possibly the texture. So I try to do as much as I can of getting the fleur de sel off the top. So when it's kind of reducing, it's skimming off the top, and it's this beautiful kind of flaky salt. So that I try to use the most, and that has a great texture because it's not too firm, but kind of larger, thin kind of flakes. Whereas the salt that goes to the bottom is more kind of fine, so it doesn't have as much texture.
Got it.
So it's more of a texture thing, I would say, than comparing it to
And what's your yield like? How much salt do you average yield out of a 5 gallon Home Depot bucket?
So I usually do 20 gallons. I do 4 or 5 gallon buckets, and I get about 15 cups of salt.
Okay. Wow, that's actually a lot more than I would have expected.
It is. And when you're making it and you see the yield, you're like, oh, that doesn't look like it very much when it's kind of spread out, drying.
Sure.
And then when I kind of put it in containers, it's kind of gross.
So how often do you have to go out and bring back buckets of water?
It's 3 to 4 times a year.
Oh, that's not so bad.
Yeah. And it's more so, I try to only do it in the winter, in the colder months, more so because of the bacterial content in the water.
Sure.
Just In the beginning, we got it tested from a lab in upstate New York just to make sure.
Yeah, of course.
Didn't think there would be a problem, but no. You don't want to be serving guests something you're not sure of. And they pretty much said this, unless there was a physical contaminant in the water, oil spill, basically, you're not going to have a problem with the salt because the salt kills a lot of bacteria anyway. So.
Sure.
So we're, 3 to 4 times a year, usually go fall, winter, spring, a couple times.
Yeah. Do you ever bring in any ingredients from Nova Scotia?
I do. A lot of seaweeds. Just actually did a dinner last night, or a fundraising dinner last night in West Orange, New Jersey, for the American Cancer Society. And for that, I did a seaweed focaccia and then a seaweed salad on top. So all the seaweed came from Nova Scotia.
Cool.
I have a forager in Nova Scotia who he forages many items, but only items I can get from him are dried items because the ship time from him is a little long.
Yeah.
So I get winter nori, sugar kelp, wakame, oyster thief, which is a really awesome seaweed.
Huh.
It's just like these long strands, really kind of almost like a fish seaweed kind of taste, but not fishy. Super unique, strong taste. So I get many, many kind of seaweeds from him.
Growing up, did you eat seaweed?
Growing up, did not eat seaweed. No, now I think of it. Although in Nova Scotia cuisine, dulse is a big
sure.
is a big one. I get dulse from him as well. There's a dish called dulse pie in Nova Scotia, which is pretty terrible. But it's dulse basically. It's the seaweed, and dulse is very kind of iodiney, really strong taste. We actually use it here at the restaurant. We smoke it and put it on the popcorn.
Yep.
That we give guests at the beginning of service. But a little bit, we put a little bit. It's kind of quite a strong seaweed. But no, I think as a kid, we didn't. This weekend, actually, I'm going to be in Nova Scotia.
Oh, nice.
And the forager, who I haven't met yet, kind of through online, that I use, is taking my whole family foraging. So,
oh, that's exciting.
It's going to be a great day on Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, so you and I share a passion for foraging.
Yes.
You know, I've been spending a lot of time in Rhode Island, been doing some great foraging up there, mostly mushrooms. My wife is into a lot of more medicinal plant.
Okay.
Foraging and that kind of thing. I've done actually very little, even though it's right on the ocean. I've done very little in the ocean, although I'm looking forward to doing a little bit more of that. How did you get into foraging?
I would say mostly my wife. My wife is from Eastern Europe, from Estonia. And the first time I went there to visit her family, we went foraging and for mushrooms. And my wife grew up foraging for mushrooms since she could walk. There's a picture of her that's, you can't even see her face. She's holding a platter of porcinis. So many porcinis, you can't even see her face. So they basically kind of trained me or kind of taught me how to kind of forage and what to look for.
Yeah.
And from then it grew. Then I was hooked. I was already a chef at the time, and kind of there's nothing better than kind of getting your own ingredients for cooking. So
yeah, I mean, there's something about it. And it's so interesting. I mean, having grown up in the United States, I feel like in Eastern Europe especially is where I meet people who just grew up with it.
Yeah.
Right, for the most part, like it's just part of the culture there. People do it, and you just grow up learning, right? You grow up in the same way that we learn that a tomato is an edible, you know, red thing that grows on a plant, and there are other, you know, edible berries, like there are other edible berries and non-edible berries. People grow up looking at mushrooms, and in this country, I feel like, or in this part of the world, up into Canada as well, people grow up thinking mushrooms are poisonous.
Correct.
If they don't come from the supermarket.
Right.
And I feel like people are missing out on such an incredible world of flavor and texture and just the enjoyment of it. I mean, you're walking through the woods, and I always feel like it's like winning the lottery. Like, if you're walking through woods you've never been in before, a couple weeks ago I'm walking through the woods, and there's a beautiful chicken of the woods specimen right there on a log, and it's like winning the lottery.
Oh, yes. Oh, it's super excitement. It's kind of, you get zoned in, and you're just kind of like focused on looking, but it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. And
do you have a particular mushroom that is like, you know, in your, that's like your favorite one to find?
Porcinis, yeah. Porcinis for sure. They're in Eastern Europe, they're the prize mushroom.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of, that's where I was taught, is kind of the prize thing. I love chanterelles. It's one of my favorites. They're not as prized there. They pick them, but they're more common, so to speak. We just were a month ago in Colorado and had an amazing harvest in Colorado. I brought back a whole ton of fresh and dried. We dried some when we were there. Porcinis and hawk's wings were just super plentiful there. Almost too plentiful. It was actually, but yeah, it's great. I'm looking forward to Nova Scotia as well.
Yeah.
Doing some.
Should
the property that
season.
I grew up on, supposedly is one of the best areas for chanterelles. And we had a large area that I could have been when I was younger, but didn't even know it.
Yeah, it's amazing how you find out about these things. I've got into mushroom foraging through some friends, and through meeting people who were doing it, and also just loving the outdoors. I do a lot of hiking, and it's from being out there and kind of starting to be like, well, what is that, right? And, you know, let me learn more about it. And at some point, about a year or two in, I went to the house where I grew up, and I went to my father's house, which is up in Westchester County, New York. And, you know, big lawn, a couple of, like, you know, there's a dozen 100-plus-foot tall oak trees, and it was in the fall, and they're beautiful hen of the woods at the base of the trees, and my jaw hit the floor, and I went and I picked them. They were the size of milk crates, and they were perfect, and my father said, oh, those have been growing there for years. I thought they were poisonous. And, you know, I never knew to look,
right?
It was completely off my radar. And here I lived in that house till I was 15. And here all those 15 years, I could have been enjoying those wonderful mushrooms.
Yeah, it is great. It is interesting.
So what about Virginia? So Virginia, you weren't near the ocean.
I was definitely not near the ocean. I was in the mountains, on the edge of the Appalachian Mountains in Lynchburg. And that's where I finished high school, and that's where I started cooking. So that's where I was working at a restaurant as a dishwasher just for a job in high school. And the chef had a good relationship with the chef, and the chef offered, would you like to start making salads? I'll give you a small raise if you want to make salads. And I was like, sure, raise sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Salad sounds easy. Let me do it. And so that kind of went on for, I worked there for 3 years, and it was probably the first 2 years that I really didn't even think about it any further than just it being a job. Then it was a trip back to Nova Scotia. I think it was at Christmas time, one holiday. Flew back to visit my mother and stepfather. And talking to my stepfather in the airport, he basically said, if you love cooking right now, why don't you pursue that? We were talking about colleges and what was going to happen. And I was originally going to go to aeronautical engineering school, was the plan. That's when I was like, well, I don't know if I'm going to love being a pilot, but I do love cooking now. So he said, why don't you try that out? You can always be a pilot afterwards. And so that's when I kind of decided to go to culinary school. Was after that.
Cool. So that just led down this road.
Exactly. Yeah. I cooked for 3 years at the first restaurant, and then went to culinary school and been cooking ever since.
Awesome. Yeah. So you sort of split your time then between Hoboken and out in Jenner, California?
Correct. I'm about 75% in Hoboken and 25% in California. Go minimum one week a year. Sorry, 1 week a month.
Yeah. There. Is there anybody else on the team? Like, are the restaurants related in any other way, or are you just the only way they're connected?
So they are. So they're related in that same main owner. Owner owns here as he does Timber Cove. We're using kind of Halifax as a, almost so to speak, a training ground for California. It's a little harder to get staff there.
Sure.
It's quite remote. It's on the Sonoma Coast, so it's not near. It's an hour and a half from the closest kind of city.
It must be a great opportunity, though, for people who you find who are interested in it.
Oh, for
right?
sure.
I mean, if you train them here and then they get to go live in Jenner.
Exactly. So the chef now at Timber Cove, he was my sous chef here up until 6-8 months ago. One of our dining room managers here is now assistant dining room manager there. So we're kind of trading staff, so to speak. Yeah.
Oh, that's very cool. And then how's the menu different from Halifax?
Quite different menu, but a similar concept. So Halifax is northeastern farm and coastal. Well, Timber Cove is Pacific farm and coastal.
Sure.
So it's kind of different items, but kind of treated the same way. Treated simply, focused on the ingredients and the season.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that 90% of Wisconsin's milk is made into cheese? And this is not just any milk. When Swiss, German, and Italian cheesemakers first settled into Wisconsin, they chose their new home because of the special terroir of the region. Its soil and water are nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin produces 25% of all cheeses made in the U.S., and Wisconsin cheeses have won more awards than any other state or country in the world. How did they do it? Wisconsin cheesemakers combined their heritage and tradition with nonstop innovation. They were the first state to establish cheese grade standards and the first to require that every cheese plant be overseen by a licensed cheesemaker. Wisconsin is the only place outside of Europe where one can pursue an elite master cheesemaker certification. All of these impeccably high standards mean Wisconsin produces more than 48% of the nation's specialty cheese.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Linda Liu, and I'm the host of Feast Meets West, the show that celebrates Asian culture through the lens of food here on HRN. Listen to episodes like The Evolution of Chinatown with Numwa Tea Parlor's Wilson Tang and New York Times Elaine Chen. Catch our ongoing series, Women in Asian Food, and spotlight episodes with our heroes like Anita Lowe. You can find Feast Meets West wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Are there any dishes that you wish you could have on the menu that, like, just don't work out because of supply chains? Like, I'm always interested to understand, you know, I mean, obviously there's been such a great movement in the last 10, 15 years towards working with farms, but of course you as the chef are dreaming up things that you might want to do, and then suddenly supply might evaporate.
Sure. So, let me think. Digby scallops is one of them, on the Digby Shore in Nova Scotia. Some of the best, sweetest scallops kind of ever had. Part of it could be growing up and nostalgia, but
yeah, sure.
I haven't had them in quite a few years. but I've tried to get those, even with Nova Scotia halibut is really big in this area. My main fish vendor brings in Nova Scotia halibut direct from the fishermen in Nova Scotia. I said, can you ask him to put on 5 pounds of Digby scallops every week, and I'll buy them. And some reason we can't get them, so huh. I've been trying to get those, because I think it'd be something very unique to this area,
yeah.
That people aren't used to.
Yeah, I mean, most of the scallops, as I understand it, around here, at least the sort of the bigger ones, are coming off the Jersey coast, but the water in Nova Scotia's got to be different. It's gotta be
colder. So the Digby area, which is in the Bay of Fundy, is the largest tidal bore in the world.
Mm.
So it drops. Can't even say how many feet, 50 feet, I
right,
think,
sure.
in a few hours. So there's large currents, and there's lots of minerals and food in the water there. So the scallops, I find the Digby scallops comparable to a bay scallop here, like a Peconic Bay,
yeah.
But they're three times the size.
Sure.
So they're larger, much larger than a bay scallop, not quite as large as kind of a diver scallop,
yep.
But it's kind of a unique, sweet scallop that's a lot larger, so that's kind of why they're unique.
Yeah, when I was a kid, we spent a lot of time in Maine, and back in the 80s and early 90s, you could get these wonderful, small, sweet shrimp.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And I assume you probably had them in Nova Scotia as well.
Yes.
And at least in Maine, that fishery has been closed now for 6-7 years.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, the populations are too small.
Yes, and it was also very short. I remember,
yeah.
when they were available, it was like 1 month of the year,
right.
a few weeks you could get them.
Yep.
And now, yes.
For sure. So when you are out on the West Coast, what sort of products are you working with out there? I assume a lot of great dairy in that area.
Yeah, the cheeses are phenomenal, yeah. in the Sonoma area. Just trying to get actually into the restaurant now, expired dairy cattle meat. Which is kind of a larger movement that's kind of been happening in the past few years.
Yeah.
And there's so many dairy cattle there that they're not really using the meat as much. So we're working on that, trying to source that at the moment. I think it's a company called Mindful Meats, which I was able to get here a couple weeks ago, and then not able to get that supply here anymore. It's coming from there. So we're working on that over there. But as far as seafood, Dungeness crab season is incredible right there. They're caught Bodega Bay, which is 45 minutes from Timber Cove, is kind of one of the hubs of where they come in. The Pacific rockfish, phenomenal, right in front of Timber Cove. On weekends, this is full of kayaks and people, kayakers fishing for rockfish, and they're caught right there, right in the front. So we use the rockfish.
Got it.
And right now, the California king salmon season is beautiful. Getting ready to come to an end here in the next couple of weeks,
yeah.
but right now, that's kind of the main items we're using.
So both of your restaurants are in hotel properties.
Correct.
Does that mean, so it seems to me, at least from looking at the Halifax site, like you guys are running an insane number of hours, right? You're open from 6:30 in the morning, and what time do you finish service at night?
Weekdays at 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock on the weekends.
Yeah. I mean, that's a long...
It is.
That's a lot of time for the kitchen to be running.
I've said a few jobs ago, I've said I wouldn't work on a hotel again because of that, because it's just kind of extra. It's tough enough having the stresses of being a chef and then having those extra hours. But there's benefits as well. There's benefits. You've got more kind of larger kitchen. I mean, in hotels, you usually have a larger kitchen, so you have more room,
sure.
more staff to be able to work on kind of new projects,
yep.
And new items.
Well, and then I imagine it's also very interesting from the customer standpoint, because you have people who are staying in the hotel, who are coming here because it's the restaurant in the hotel. But then especially being where we are in relationship to New York City and in New Jersey, people are coming here for dinner because it's a great restaurant as
Correct.
Well, right? It's not
Correct.
Just the people who are staying in the hotel. So I think, to me, that I would imagine that adds kind of an interesting mix of customer base.
That's correct here at Halifax, you're 100%. Yeah. Timber Cove is quite different because there you're kind of stuck. You're staying
right.
there. There's not, the closest other restaurant is 30 minutes away.
Right.
The roads there are beautiful, but not to drive at night. So
no.
most people staying at Timber Cove will come in for dinner every night that they're there.
Yeah.
Breakfast and lunch, sometimes they go elsewhere during the day.
Sure.
They'll go on day trips, but mostly for dinner we have a captive audience there.
Which I imagine also is kind of neat, right? Because everybody's kind of there together, right? Everyone's
sure.
kind of like stuck in together.
Exactly.
And it's a relatively old property, is that right? That
it is.
It's been reopened?
Right, correct. We took over 4 years ago. The owner took over 4 years ago and renovated the property, trying to keep it kind of in the natural, original look as possible, but kind of bring it a little more upscale. But it is, I think it was built in the 50s.
Yes. God, I can't even imagine driving those roads in like the 50s.
I can't. Sometimes I can't imagine how we do it now.
For sure.
It's, yeah,
I have a friend
right.
who used to live in San Francisco and lives in Bolinas now.
Mm-hmm.
And God, that drive over Mount Tam to get out to his place. I mean, I've done that drive at night in the fog. And I like, I have a pretty strong stomach, but that's like the worst roller coaster ride.
Yes. Yes. For sure.
Who are the suppliers that you're working with in the New York area? I saw Fossil Farms commented on one of your Instagram posts.
Yes, so Fossil Farms is a great, great partner. We actually have a half hog coming from them tomorrow.
Cool.
So we get a lot of our meats through them. So we're getting our ground lamb through them. We're getting half hog, which is raised on their farm in Boontown,
yep.
right outside of Boontown,
yep.
New Jersey. So they're wonderful. Get bison from them as well. They raise bison, they raise ostrich, emu, hogs, all on their farm close by. But most of our pork products are coming from them.
Cool. Do you get to do any experimenting with, I guess, what I would call like odd products on your own? Like I'm thinking, like, you know, since you have a relationship with like forager, do you ever get people that have hunted like bear, and you get opportunity to work with anything like that? Not in a restaurant, obviously, because you can't sell that stuff.
Right. So not any really hunters do I kind of work with. But some odd items, kind of foraged items that my local forager here in New Jersey will kind of send me. As one is a shrimp, they call it, I think it's something etaloma. So it's a shrimp of the woods.
I've never found those as a forager, but I definitely, they're on my sort of on my
They're
radar,
very interesting. Yeah. So he'll basically text me, hey, I've got a pound of these, I'll throw on your order for you to try out. Same thing with my forager in Nova Scotia. When I first was working with him, a lot of the items that he would listed, I was like, I don't even know what that is, as far as wild foraged
yeah.
kind of berries and different items, different herbs. And so, for example, the oyster thief, he sent me that as a sample, and it was incredible. So now I'm ordering that from him. I get my local fish company, Local 130 is my main local fish company. They're based out of Asbury Park, New Jersey, and they only kind of deal with local fish. So I can't necessarily get everything from them, depending on what I need for parties. But it's one item that I got was interesting from them. He had a whole bunch of tuna hearts. I never worked with tuna
wow.
hearts before, so I said, you know what? Let me try curing them. I'm going to think of like something like Botarga.
Yeah.
So actually, they're almost ready. So they've been cured, and now they're drying out.
Oh, very cool.
To kind of, that might be terrible. That might be amazing. we'll see.
So then, items like that, like how do you fit those into the menu? Because you're running a restaurant that's open from 6:30 in the morning. For serving people who might be business travelers or might be on vacation, staying here all the way to your nighttime business, serving more people that might be coming out for an anniversary dinner or something like that, or just going out to dinner who live in the neighborhood. Where does something like the tuna heart fit? Does it become a special? Does it become something that you send out just to regulars? Like, how does it work?
It depends on what it is and how much I have.
Sure.
So for the tuna hearts, I have a couple pounds, which if you use it like Botarga, we're lightly grated on top of a pasta.
Yep.
Then it should last kind of quite a while.
Yeah.
It could most likely be special. Those type of items probably wouldn't menu them unless it turns out amazing and I can get a constant supply.
Sure.
Most of these small items, especially if they're foraged, you can't necessarily menu because you never know if you're going to get them or not.
Right, absolutely.
So currently on one of our dishes on the menu, I use local foraged mushrooms, and that's how I have on the menu because I don't know if it's going to be chicken of the woods, if it's going to be oysters, hen of the woods, shrimp at Deloma, depending on what it is.
Yeah.
So it's like I just kind of leave it to where I can menu it because it definitely have local.
It will have local.
But I don't know what that will be.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that's awesome, and I really, I respect that. you're really trying to use those items that are coming from around us, right? Because there are those things. You mentioned in your pre-show questionnaire, I asked you to fill out that your big pet peeve is that, you know, when people put that something is, say, wild mushrooms on a menu and it's not. I had that experience recently. I was at a restaurant and it said, you know, the dish contained wild mushrooms. And I thought, oh, cool, I love wild mushrooms. I wonder what it is. And I got the dish and it was just cremini's.
Yes,
you know, that's just like terrible. I could buy at the A&P. I mean, it's not any different. And, you know, unfortunately, it was not, you know, it was not a restaurant where I knew anybody. And it was, you know, but if I did, I would have said something. And, you know, they can put the word wild in front of it if they want because there's nobody checking up, right?
Correct. That's unfortunate. A lot of places will do that. And part of it might not even realize, depending on it. It might could be ignorance that they don't realize that all mushrooms are not wild.
Sure.
So it could be part of that. So it might be a kind of a harmless meaning, but right. For us that kind of that enjoy the wild mushrooms, it is disappointing not to see that.
Is there anything that came in like today into the kitchen that you're excited to work with?
The king salmon just being cut right this minute are absolutely gorgeous. These are California king. They're massive. They're the biggest ones we've got in so far this season, which is great because it's towards the end of the season. So,
yep.
But they're beautiful, gorgeous right now.
And you live in Manhattan, right?
Correct. Yeah, Midtown East.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you commute out here to Jersey, and
exactly,
then...
exactly. And I took the train for the first week I was here, and then my wife suggested I was on the weekends. It was about an hour and a half to get home, and my wife said, "Why don't you try driving? Because we have a car in the city." Unfortunately, we have a car in the city, so I said, "Let me try it." And I haven't taken the train since. It's half the time. It's kind of I can listen to the radio.
So having a car in the city is, you know, sometimes can be really great. I mean, because when you travel at off hours, it can make things so much easier. For my daughter's birthday, we asked her what she wanted to eat for her birthday, and she said that she wanted to have Mongolian hot pot because we sometimes go out to Flushing. And I was like, I don't really want to schlep all the way out to Flushing. And I remembered that there's a spot on Bowery. We live in Brooklyn. And, you know, it was 7 o'clock, and it took us 14 minutes to get there by car.
Yes.
It would have taken us more than an hour on the train. It would have taken us 40 minutes to drive to Flushing.
Right.
And we drove right into Manhattan, and, you know, parking right in front, because the parking had just gone from commercial to residential at 7 o'clock. Parked right in front of the restaurant. It took us 10 minutes to get home. So it was totally, totally worth it.
But then you have the opposites when you think it'll take 14 minutes, and it takes you 2 hours. But.
I mean, that's just what we get, right?
Yes.
I have this sort of working theory that living in the city and living, like, people that live in the city and people who live in rural places actually are much more similar in the way they approach life than people who live in the suburbs. Because if you live in a rural place, sometimes you don't know, like, what's going to happen, and you're beholden to things like weather, and you are beholden to things like, you know, if the power goes out, stuff like that. If you live in the city, you're beholden to things like travel time.
Yes.
And you just have to deal with it, right?
Right?
Like, if the subway is packed and late and there's an accident, or there's an accident on the highway, you just have to deal with it. But I feel like people who live in the suburbs, you know, they want everything to be air conditioned, and you go from your car into your garage and into your house, and then you go into your car and you go to your, you know, you go to the movie theater, like everything is controlled. And so people, I feel like, have a much harder time dealing with change.
Right.
But if you live in the city or you live in a rural place,
for sure.
I feel like we're pretty good at it.
Yeah.
What about events? I mean, this restaurant's pretty big. We're sitting in Halifax right now. I assume you guys do a lot of events here.
We do. That's what we're set up for right behind me now. We have parties actually every night this week.
Oh, wow.
Except for Saturday. We have events booked. Sometimes they're small. Tonight's a 13-person small corporate group. Last night was a 25-person group. The night before we had two groups. We'll do full restaurant buyouts as well. So we have corporate kind of buyouts or weddings. We did a wedding a couple months ago. But we do quite a bit of events, especially in the back dining room where cool. We're sitting now.
Yeah, and then are you able to play a little bit more as a chef in those kind of things?
Not as
or?
Much with the events,
yeah.
More so in the restaurant for sure.
Got it.
So the restaurants, we do specials kind of whenever we can get in.
Yeah.
We'll do specials. But for events that kind of booked weeks or months out,
yeah.
set menus. But yeah, we try to play in the kitchen a lot. To me, that's experimenting and playing with food is what keeps all the chefs and all the cooks kind of interested. If they're just cooking the same food every day for years on end, they're going to get bored. So we're trying to change things up and have some fun.
Totally. Is there anywhere that you want to travel for culinary reasons? Like any place you haven't been that you're interested in checking
out? Sure.
Out?
Japan's at the top of the list. Never been to Japan. Super fascinated with the culture, the food. I mean, a lot of my cuisine is actually, not a lot, I would say, but part of my cuisine is influenced by Japanese cooking.
Sure.
I've never worked in a Japanese restaurant. But I have had worked with some chefs that have been Japanese trained.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where some of my dishes kind of are influenced by. For example, the mushroom broth on my sea bream dish, it's really a mushroom dashi.
Right.
And it's basically exactly what it is. Don't call it a dashi on the menu, just because we're not really a Japanese restaurant, yep. But that's basically what it is. But I would love to travel there to kind of see it myself and kind of jump into the cuisine a little more.
Well, and listening to you speak about your food and your influences, it's very similar, right? I mean, Nova Scotia is an island, mm-hmm. right? A lot of the food comes from the water. That's where you grew up, and it's sort of where you've come back to with your food here and with the sort of idea of it. And Japan's the same, right? I mean, so much of the food there, you know, I mean, they weren't really eating much in terms of land animals, you know, until right. like 19th century, really.
Yeah.
It was all from the ocean.
Yeah, their seaweed culture is amazing
yeah.
to me.
Their seaweed game is
really
strong.
Their whole seafood, but their seaweed is just incredible to me with what they're doing with seafood. Yeah. Seaweed.
Yeah. Awesome. Any other things on the horizon for you? Like, do you see yourself opening more restaurants?
Certainly. Yeah. Certainly, yeah. I mean, I have a few ideas. I'd love to do kind of more of a higher end, but more casual tasting menu type menu where the items are changing. I think this, in my opinion, is probably most chefs' dream to have a small restaurant like
sure.
that. Sometimes it's not feasible. I would also like to do some couple casual concepts that I'm kind of working on, possibly in New Jersey, possibly in Brooklyn or yeah. Manhattan. We'll see.
Yeah. After spending all this time in the kitchen at work, do you cook at home?
Not as much as I would like to. Definitely not as much as my wife would like me to. I live in Manhattan, so my kitchen is not a massive kitchen, quite small. Fortunately, I do have a kitchen, but it's to cook in the kitchen is, as a chef, for me at least, I need to have my tools, I need to have enough space. It's kind of frustrating working in a kitchen at home that's just tiny and limited, and then you got to clean up after yourself.
Right.
So it's, but we go out to eat quite a bit. Living in Manhattan, it's kind of, you got a good excuse not to cook at home.
It's true.
You can kind of go wherever you want. We go out to eat quite a bit, yeah.
What's one great thing that you ate this week?
This week, I would say the Wagyu tacos at Californos in San Francisco. My wife's anniversary was last week, 10-year anniversary, and we went to Californos. She came with me to Timber Cove, and then we went for anniversary dinner before flying back. But it was incredible.
Awesome.
Yeah, very good restaurant.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Chef, so much for taking time out of your busy day to sit down with me and talk about all this stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to rate and review the show. Please reach out to me if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. And remember, go to www.heritageradionetwork.org/gala and get your tickets today.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.